Jarring Cacophony tells you it's time for another book, it's time for another doctor. It's actually the same one that we featured last time we did the book. But yes, we are carrying on these interesting journeys into the world of Doctor Who publishing. I'm Kenny Smith, this is the Power of Three podcast, and I'm here with my fellow book lover, man who's now read his second book in almost as many weeks. Stevie Day. Hi, Stevie.
Hello, what a lovely introduction. Yes, my second book in as many weeks, and of the year, Kenny, of the year. This is number two. I should say, just a brief recap, it's not that I don't read. I spend my days reading in work. I read and read and read and read and read and absorb, and I think by the time I get to free time, I don't want to read anymore. Mm-hmm. But I have thoroughly enjoyed listeners being forced to read books. I mean, asked to read books by our Kenny, and I am enjoying. So let's hope this is a continuing thing.
Absolutely. So today we're going to be having a look at The Nightmare of Black Island, written by Mike Tucker, which features the 10th Doctor and Rose. And tell you what, shall I give you some info about it?
Kenny, could you give us some info about it?
I will indeed, Stevie. This was the 10th novel in the BBC New Series Adventure series, and it was published by BBC Books on the 21st of September 2006. It was given a cover by Henry Stedman as well, and it's got 252 pages. I don't think anybody needs to know that it's ISBN 0/563/48650/3.
Somebody will want to know that.
They probably will. Shall I tell you what the back cover blurb has to say?
Kenny, could you tell us what the back cover blurb has to say?
All right, why not? On a lonely stretch of Welsh coastline, a fisherman is killed by a hideous creature from beneath the waves. When the Doctor and Rose arrive, they discover a village where the children are plagued by nightmares and the nights are ruled by monsters. The villagers suspect that ancient industrialist Nathaniel Morton is to blame, but the Doctor has suspicions of his own. Who are the ancient figures that sleep in the old priory? What are the monsters that prowl the woods after sunset? What is the light that glows in the disused lighthouse on Black Island? As the children's nightmares get worse, the Doctor and Rose discover an alien plot to resurrect an ancient evil. I feel the urge to go and pretend I'm stroking an evil beard, but I don't have a beard, so let's come on, Stevie, let's stroke our pretend evil beards. Before we continue, why don't we hear a quick excerpt from the book, and it's going to be read for us by Anthony Head off of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Ooh, is he going to bring coffee?
Let's find out.
The Doctor peered at it in puzzled fascination. The creature seemed wrong somehow, thrown together, not the product of any normal evolutionary process. He took a step forward, intending to get a closer look, but Rose hauled him back frantically. "What are you doing?"
"Wanted to see if I could get a better look at it." He gave her a stern look. "It's not at all like you described it, nothing like. Wrong number of arms, for starters. We'll have to give you a few lessons in alien identification when we get back to the TARDIS."
"If we get back to the TARDIS, you mean? Besides, it's not the wrong number of arms, because that's not the thing I saw."
There was a shattering roar from behind them. The two of them spun to see another creature emerging from the shadows.
"That's the one I saw," said Rose.
"Oh, righto, sorry." The Doctor gave her a weak smile. "I think it might be time to run now." Rose rolled her eyes.
"You think? Run!"
The Doctor and Rose plunged off the path, pushing through the tangle of tree roots and brambles. Behind them they could hear the frustrated roars of the creatures and sounds of trees crashing to the floor as the two monsters tried to tear their way through in pursuit. They're too big to follow us in here, shouted the doctor. Keep to where the wood is dense. The two of them struggled forward, ducking under fallen trees, scrambling up muddy banks. Finally, the doctor waved at Rose to stop. Slow down. I think we've lost them. Rose slumped against a tree, breathing hard. She tilted her head back, letting raindrops from the leaves splash on her face. We're nearly out of the woods, the doctor nodded through the trees. Ahead of them, about 200 meters away, yellow light glowed warmly. Street lamps? The doctor nodded. Civilization of a sort. Rose smiled, then froze. The rain splashing onto her face had suddenly gone warm and thick. She wiped a hand across her face and saw strands of sticky slime trailing from her fingers. She looked up in disgust and screamed. A huge centipede loomed over her, hanging from an overhead branch. It must have been over 2 meters long, its thick body bristling with hairs and thick slime dripping from its razor-sharp mandibles. It lunged at her, hissing viciously. Suddenly there was a sharp, piercing whine and the creature dropped from the tree, writhing in agony. The doctor stood there, sonic screwdriver held out before him, the blue light at its tip gleaming brightly in the gloom. He handed Rose a large spotted handkerchief and she wiped her face gratefully. How many more of those things are up there? The doctor nodded over her shoulder, his face grim. Lots, unfortunately.
Big thanks to Tony for reading that there for us. I tell you, this bottomless address book of mine, it comes in very handy.
It's brilliant. And it's nice that he did leave a jar there.
It is.
I'm hoping that is coffee.
And people, of course, can get a copy of this official BBC audiobook online. And it was recently re-released as part of the 10th Doctor Novels, volume, I think it was in volume 1, maybe volume 2. Anyway, you can still get a nice compilation version of it if you can't find it secondhand on eBay or other places like that. So, Stevie, what did you think of this one? Last time we spoke about a Doctor and Martha book, how did you find this one?
Yeah, that's another cracking book. And really good characterization, again, in with the Doctor and Rose as off telly. You know, could have filmed this. It's a lot. It's a book. Obviously, there's a lot left to the imagination. But a really good use of, we're told what the monsters are and what they look like. But you're busy conjuring, well, what else could be produced by the children? Oops, sorry, shouldn't have said that. Spoilers. By the children throughout the book. And yeah, a really good fast romp, I felt. It didn't lag anywhere at all. Yeah, really good, really easy, straightforward. Really easy, that sounds bad. It sounds like there was no thought put into it. Lots of thought put into it. Sped through this one. A good wee page turner.
Definitely, it definitely is. I think it's... Mike Tucker knows what makes Doctor Who work. He knows what makes the scares work and things like that. I mean, yeah. The whole stuff at the start of the book with the fishing and getting like the hook through the finger, just like,
that's the kind of thing that makes you go. I mean, even down to the point of, and I should say first, I love Wales. Hi everyone in Wales. I love Yucky Wales. Da. I love visiting. Always love visiting. I live on the west coast of Scotland. This is Wales. Our weather is similar. He's got the weather down to a T. I have been to Wales when it has been parched and lovely and in a drought. I've also been to Wales when they were selling snorkels at the Severn Bridge as we crossed. But you know, he'd got that down to a T. And as you say, spearing yourself on the hooks and you're like, really good.
I mean, that all the stuff with when the Doctor and Rose arrive and they're going through the forest and there's like the monsters in the trees and just think, this is absolutely, you know, sort of nightmarish qualities. It so works. But then, you know, as it goes on, it almost goes Enid Blyton-like with the secret tunnel and things like that and the kids and their gang and things like that. So you're getting Famous Five, Secret Seven vibes.
That's what it should be about. It's a bit like the gang of children in The Empty Child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's slightly different, but it's great to have a wee gang of children. You didn't have the Doctor for a period, and you had Nancy and the kids. And again, this is nice, and I always loved the Famous Five, and the thoughts of them scrambling through. I do have a note about, I mean, you talked about the priory there.
Yes.
But most of the book mentions the rectory. I don't know if, you see, I'm a child of the manse, never been referred to as the priory. Now, as a child of the manse, I have lived in many rectories over my dad's tenure in many places, and some of them were bigger than others. This one goes on forever. I'd quite like to see this rectory because I want to have that space. But he did such a good job of describing it, but I honestly thought it's going to take you a good 10 minutes to get from one side of this building to the other.
It's fab. And it's, then of course we've got the actual island itself when the Doctor, yes, goes out there, and we find that there's, surprise, surprise, a crashed, abandoned alien spaceship there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But were you getting Rutan vibes from this one, thinking, oh, because I know I certainly was, because I was thinking, there's an island, it's got a lighthouse on it,
yeah,
and just thinking, like, this could be a really neat way of doing Rutans and horrifying rock for the 21st century.
I was thinking, oh, I wonder if, but I know there's limitations on what they can do in the books, and maybe that wouldn't be allowed, but yeah, no, I was definitely getting, ooh, I wonder if, I was a wee bit surprised at a metal lighthouse on an island.
Yes, lightning strikes.
Lightning strikes. But, you know, he made a big thing of, you know, monsters clanging against trying to get through the door and stuff. I suppose I was just surprised there are metal lighthouses. I went up and checked. But, yes, I did think about electricity and lightning strikes and stuff. But, yeah, what's not to like about a lighthouse? Shame there wasn't a Rutan, but that would be a bit formulaic, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Rutans invade a planet. Right, Rutans, I've been thinking we'd invade, so head to the nearest lighthouse immediately. Why, Commander? Because that way we can get killed quick. No, but maybe that's their invasion plans. They only go for places with lighthouses. Yeah. Anyway, I digress, because there weren't any Rutans.
No, but it's still very, very enjoyable, I think, the whole...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it feels, I mean, as you say, I've been to Wales a few times. You see, first time I went, we nearly got drowned when we did the city bus tour, with rain sloshing around before we went to do the Doctor Who studio tour, or not Doctor Who studio, so the Doctor Who experience. So may its soul rest in peace.
Yes.
And yeah, just, it was a real experience, and it was, yeah. So when I could read this, I haven't gone that far up the Welsh coast, but I could picture it very, very akin to the Scottish coast, having done a little bit of Googling, mm-hmm, and having a look and seeing it. Yes, there's definitely a lot of similarities with that sort of bleak rock, and I suppose you could almost think like alpine type plants, just with that,
yeah,
shrubbery and bushland, yeah, almost just being windswept and blasted by the conditions.
It's a funny thing, Wales, that you, even on the Gower Peninsula, you can't see sometimes anything beyond. So you forget where you are, and you wonder, you know, think, oh, there's nothing for miles and miles and miles, but there is. there's the south of England almost, and then you've crossed to Ireland. But it is very similar, and the weather conditions are suitably vague and wet.
Yes, definitely damp. But no, it definitely worked for me. And the other thing I really thought that might get spot on were the Doctor and Rose. They've got that. He absolutely captured the confidence in their friendship relationship,
yeah, yeah,
and the fact you could pretty much throw them into any situation and the pair of them will absolutely cope every single time.
Yeah, yeah, no, there's no doubt, you know, Mike has got, he's just got them completely. I hadn't realised he was one of the visual effects guys.
Yes.
And a good writer has worked on so many things, and working through Doctor Who, you know what works, as you said, what works and what doesn't, and, you know, great, fantastic job. And of course that allows him to possibly put things in that would be really difficult to visualize well, but, you know, he knows what he would want, and of course in our imaginations and through reading, his descriptions are so good that we, yep, know exactly, and the way he does the Doctor and Rose, and he does that good thing of splitting them up. Because that, again, that's a good way to do these stories. That, yes, when they're together, it's great, but yet you separate them and put them in peril and then bring them back together.
Yeah, particularly when Rose goes off to investigate the priory stroke rectory,
yep.
And encountering the rather nasty lady in there. And
yes.
I think there's a lot of, there's definitely, I think Mike's definitely, you can tell that he's worked in the show and seen David and Billy up close.
Yeah, yeah.
Very much got their dynamic, that friendship, that sort of love interest. It all bounces along mm-hmm. at a great pace. Any particular moments that we've not mentioned that struck you?
Well, I was going to say that I thought this as I read through it. Now, if you miss out what we just said about the Doctor and Rose's relationship here, you know, and how they are, this, to me, could have been a Third Doctor setting.
Yeah,
you
see
know,
that.
The pub, the village. I mean, it's also a bit Children of Earth with the children, because you know, they're going to meet a horrible end if everything's not careful. And very much a third Doctor thing. I think the main baddie, Nathaniel Morton.
Yep.
You do think, I don't know, it's for all for entertainment, but you do think that some of these, you know, retired industrialists might one day look at something and think, is this too good to be true? Because,
yeah.
You know, bad things were happening and he, in inverted commas, didn't notice. But you need something like that. You need that baddie like that to come in and cause chaos. And then at the end, trying to work out, actually, I've done it wrong, but it's too late. It's too late. I thought the description of the aliens was quite interesting, especially, what was the...
Synrogs.
Yes. And the chief one, what was her name?
Yes.
Yes. And, you know, and the fact that, you know, they've got their masks on and eventually they discard with them and think there's no point in pretending anymore. I find that quite amusing. You can almost see that going, what's the point? You know, everyone knows we're up to no good now.
Is it Miss Payne?
It's Miss Payne, because the Baylor is the
yes.
is the entity.
Yes.
But yes, she's quite a lovely character. And also So we had the older lady who lost her boy, Bronwyn.
Yes, who goes out to the boat? Who goes out to the island?
The island. She's kind of that nobody in the pub likes her. You know, she's a bit weird and so on. And when everything was resolved and she was suddenly young again, so Bronwyn was, you know, she was quite a lovely character throughout the book, and I felt. I don't know, it's one of these ones when somebody is rejuvenated or given another chance or whatever, sometimes that can work and sometimes it can't. Sometimes you're happy for that. I was pleased with what they did, but that was a bit sad what happened. I know she gets to live again and so on, but that was a high point for me in that way. That sounds terrible. It's a high point because someone's life has been ruined and now they've been made young again. But no, it was a good point in the book. So yeah, that kind of stuck out for me. That the lighthouse, the pub people, let's call them the pub people, and Ali. So we concentrate on Ali quite a lot, and she's with Rose in the tunnels and. She's obviously been frightened about all these things and she's gone to the rectory and chapped on the window or whatever and run away again. And she's a standout character for me. And you do really worry about her, about what's going to happen. And maybe it's not a common thing, but the thought of being kept awake. I don't know if you've ever been kept awake, Kenny.
Oh, once or twice.
But absolutely on purpose for scientific reasons?
No.
Oh, it's horrible. It's horrible. I was on a kind of study thing and they kept you awake for a period of time, even though beyond, you know, you had sort of 10 minutes in a 16-hour period and you had to be... you know, they kept monitoring you and you just saw the difference in how you were and when you really wanted to sleep and there's someone in front of you saying, you've got to stay awake now, you've got to stay awake.
Mm.
And it's quite, oh. And this brought back a few memories of that. But, you know, there's also the fear of going to sleep. You know, if you're worried about something, you don't want to go to sleep. And this was all mixed up within this book. So he had a good few tricks that would rattle a few people's brains, I think, you know, just ordinary Joes, and they would bring back a lot of things, and they'd think, oh, I remember when this happened.
Yeah, Mike is a genius for that sort of thing. So why don't we stop yakkering now, because I'm sure that the listeners will be desperate to hear from the man who wrote the book, Mr. Mike Tucker. Shall we pass over to him?
Please, let's pass over to Mr. Mike Tucker.
Hi, my name's Mike Tucker, and I was the author of The Nightmare of Black Island.
You certainly were. What a great title as well. It just is so evocative straight away. Did the title come to you pretty quickly?
Yeah, I mean, I'm my Doctor Who is always the horror-based Doctor Who's. I maintain that Doctor Who is not a science fiction series, it's a horror series, and it works best as a horror series, as long as that horror is couched in the sort of science fiction world that Doctor Who inhabits. So your Pyramids of Mars, your Image of the Fendal, Plant of Evil, all those shows. So when I was pitching this particular book, The Nightmare of Black Island summed up everything I wanted it to evoke, if you like.
Very much so. Now, I believe that before you wrote this, you had been down to previously write another new series novel.
Yeah, I was down to do one of the third batch of Ninth Doctor books. And it was a story called Reign of Terror. Reign as in R-A-I-N, very much done as a pun. And it was a Ninth Doctor Rose and Captain Jack story, which had been pitched, approved, and accepted. And then Russell's notes came back, Russell D. Davis's notes came back on the book. And they were robust notes, a lot of changes he wanted. And at the same time, I picked up a huge contract at the BBC to do the effects for a three-part mini-series called Egypt's Golden Empire. And it became very obvious to me that I would not be able to do the book in the timescale that was given and the effects work. One was going to suffer. And so I phoned Justin Richards, who was the editor, and I said, I'm going to have to bow out of this. And Steve Lyons took the slot that I would have had with Stealers of Dreams, which I was gutted about, to be honest. I mean, the show was back. It was going to be huge. The royalties were reasonable. And I had to turn it down. That story ended up being recycled as a Matt Smith, Rory, and Amy story for Penguin, also called Reign of Terror, which was published as part of their two-in-one range a couple of years later. So if you wanted to know what story I was going to do would be, just go and read that one and just replace the Doctor with the correct Doctor and then Amy and Rory with Rose and Jack, and you've pretty much got the gist of it. But then Justin didn't give up on me and said, okay, we're back the following year. I think it was the following year. I can't remember if I was the first or the second batch.
I think it was the second, because I think
I think I was the second batch again, yeah. And that was Nightmare of Black Island.
It must have been a real joy, given that you'd seen what was happening on screen, and obviously from working on the show, you had a good idea as to how the storytelling style had evolved from what you'd previously done with BBC books to this new faster-paced stories, and of course, better for you as a shorter length as well.
Yeah, I mean, they were definitely punchier and pacier. And yes, I'd been involved with the show enough to know what was coming. And the different vocal patterns of this new Doctor, this far more casual approach to writing the Doctor. But the BBC were very good. I mean, A, they knew I'd already signed all the non-disclosure agreements because I was working on the show as an effects designer. But we were taken down and we were shown a couple of episodes of Tennant. So we had a good sense of what was coming down. And we had Simon Winston, who was script editor for those, working over the books as well. So there was very definitely a sense that you were being guided to make sure that everything you did sat within what Russell and the team were doing. So yeah, it was a good experience. It was not unpleasant on any level. We were allowed a certain amount of creative freedom as long as we sat within the guidelines that we'd been given.
It must have been a real joy being asked to do this. And of course, this is when we had three books, a past, a present, and a future setting. So yeah. Did you request to have the present day one?
No, I did not. I mean, with all the books that I've submitted to the BBC, they always ask for three pitches, three one-page pitches. And so I gave them three one-page pitches. And ironically, I think, every time I've pitched three stories, I've always had a favourite and a least favourite in those three. Every time I've done it, they've picked the one that is my least favourite of the ones I've picked. Which means that you have to work that little bit harder to actually get something out of it you're going to enjoy. But Russell and Justin, because I'm not going to dismiss the work Justin did in pushing this one, liked the setting, it was Welsh, it was, you know, a lighthouse, a disused lighthouse. It was very kid friendly in as much that there's a large cast of kids in it. So that's the one that they went for. Russell said, oh, that's the one I really, really like. And off we went, you know. So once it had been chosen, it was a question of right now, just knuckle down, take that one page outline and expand it out, and then just crack on and write it.
You mentioned there the Welsh setting, which I thought was absolutely appropriate, given that it's a series that's made in Wales. And we didn't too often get properly set in Wales stories. I'm still surprised also I've never been back to the Eye of Orion, given the proximity to that location, but there we go. But no, was that an obvious thing for you to do, to sort of to capture and capitalise on that?
I mean, I'm Welsh. I mean, I was born and brought up in Bridgend and Swansea. I went to school with Russell. And the lighthouse that's actually on the cover of Nightmare of Black Island is a photograph that I took of a lighthouse out on the Gower Peninsula that I used to visit a lot in my youth, particularly when Rob Perry and I, who was my old co-writer for the BBC books that I did, Sylvester McCoy era, we used to go out to this lighthouse a lot. So there's a lot of things in this story that hark back to my childhood in Wales. The setting is very, very much the sort of places that I grew up in and used to hang out in. It's very much the sort of stories I liked. And the very fact that it's set, you know, in the heart of winter, and there's rain and dark nights and thunderstorms, all of that is tied up with my memory of watching Doctor Who. So it's a very personal book from that point of view. It was also something that gave me a nice grounded sort of comfort factor, if you like, in that it's, with the exception of one of the books that I'd done previously, this was my first solo novel. I'd done Primetime solo, but with Robert as a sort of sounding board, whereas this one was me really going out on my own to write something. And I was really pleased with the way it turned out. I mean, I think I was able to bring some of my Welsh heritage into it. It was funny because the opening of the book has got a character who basically gets killed off in the opening scenes by the monsters, Carl. There's an entire scene with him driving to Wales and going over the Severn Bridge. And he comments that crossing the Severn Bridge and putting the toll coins into the machine is like putting money into a washing machine because the heavens open. And Simon Winston came back to me and said, I'm not sure we should be dissing Wales quite this much. And I went, no, I am Welsh and it's true. You know, it's a cliche, but it's true. My mum and I used to say all the time, and my dad, we used to drive back over the Severn Bridge and it would start raining the instant you hit the Welsh coastline. So I'm not being unpleasant about where I grew up. I'm just trying to be truthful about where I grew up.
It's affectionate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like that when we've been down to visit family down in England. And as soon as you cross the border, past Carlisle, you get into Scotland, whoom, the weather changes entirely. It could be a beautiful sunny day, you know, 20 degrees something in England, and then you get to Scotland, get down to like 9 degrees if you're lucky.
Yeah, get exactly. Wrapped up. So it felt true to my childhood. So,
Talking of childhood, did you ever have an incident with when with any sort of fishing hook, because that struck me as that sounds like somebody who's had that experience going through the finger.
It wasn't, but I was always wary of them. So there's a little bit of me coming into that. But yeah, I mean, whenever my dad used to open up this canvas bag with fishing hooks in it, I was always told to keep away from them. You know, they're dangerous. So as I've become older, although fishing hooks are not an issue for me, I have a needle phobia. So it's a combination of those two things has sort of come together. And it seemed like a good sort of hook to start the book.
Very good, you win.
Yeah, it just everything just, it dropped into place nicely. The fish hooks, him getting them in his fingers, the blood, and then the monster and the attack. I mean, it's quite brutal.
Yes, it definitely is. It's quite child friendly brutal. The horror's there. I think when you've got that little bit more life experience, you think, that's nasty. But when it's, if you're a kid, it's like, oh, blood, dead.
Yeah.
It's fine. But when you think about it more, yeah.
It's Hammer horror.
That's exactly it. Exactly. And I love Hammer films. Even when I was 7 and 8, The Devil Rides Out, when the Angel of Death appeared, apparently the first time I saw that, I did a somersault over the sofa. I was terrified. And you look at it now and it's like, oh. And at one point, they've almost like forgotten to key in the, where there's the blue screen. There's just like one shot and it's in a blue. What? Anyway, terrified me back then. So, the big question, how do we pronounce the village name? At a guess, I would guess Innisdu.
Innisdu.
Ah. Yeah.
So the U in Welsh, as in Cymru, is pronounced E. So it's Innisdu. And it literally does mean Black Island.
There we go. We've learned something new already. I can pronounce Llanaidin, which is where I often stay in a travel lodge if I'm down in Cardiff. So not Llanadairn as
no.
Somebody was. Lots of
guttural and spit needed for Welsh. But even my aliens, you know, the Cynrog or Sunrog, Cynrog, I tried to give it an almost Celtic feel, the Cynrog. When Anthony Stewart Head did the reading of this, he said it's almost like deliberately you've played into the Welsh. And it's like, yes, well, if you're going to go whole hog.
Very much so. I did have a quick Google to see if that meant anything, but it just sounds very, very Welsh.
I just wanted something that sounded good.
Oh, it most definitely did. Most definitely did. So I imagine then that creating that setting with, it's that American Werewolf in London kind of, the Doctor knows, turning up at the pub, having escaped the monsters, and it's just that wonderful, really evocative. You can imagine it in your mind's eye, and you can almost believe that you could have seen it in TV. That's the way that I came away from it. Just thought, yeah, I can really imagine that as being a TV setting.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when I was doing the Sylvester McCoy, Sophie Aldred, Seventh Doctor and Ace books for the BBC, Steve Cole, who was my editor for a huge number of those, said that he always felt that the books Rob Perry and I delivered were Doctor Who, but in widescreen. And of course, here we are in a world where Doctor Who was now in widescreen. So it was a question of upping that budget level a little bit more to something that I don't see the point in being asked to write a Doctor Who book and then writing something so far removed from the TV series on which it's based that it doesn't feel like a Doctor Who story. So mine is a Doctor Who story with a decent budget. That's I write what I would like to watch.
I think so.
The fairest way I can put it. I would like to have sat and watched The Nightmare of Black Island on television. I'm not sure they'd necessarily have been able to afford it. These days, I don't know whether that's true or not. Maybe I'm underwriting for the budget these days. But at the time, that's definitely my way of going at this. Write a big budget Doctor Who story, Doctor Who the feature film, but still recognisably Doctor Who.
You've mentioned Rob Perry a few times, of course. He maybe didn't get a credit, but Bob Perry, the Harbour Master?
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely my little thank you, Robert.
Excellent. Of course, something that I was slightly wrong-footed by was we've got a story set by the seaside. There's mysterious creatures around. There's a lighthouse. I was thinking Rutans. And that's a lovely wrong foot, the fact that it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, you want to take some of the tropes that sort of are around your favourite Doctor Who stories, but they're not necessarily go the same route. So there wasn't a conscious decision to sort of be horror fang rock. It was more a question of having got a seaside setting, I needed a deserted location, and a deserted lighthouse was perfect for it. In any way, in the same way that me having the Doctor and Rose stumble into a pub is exactly the same as them arriving in a pub in the Android Invasion or Terror of the Zygons. It's a set of cliches, if you like, but those cliches work because they are exactly what you expect of a setup like this. So I don't pretend that I'm trying to necessarily do anything spectacularly clever here. I know what I like. I know that there hadn't been a David Tennant story set in this sort of location, and therefore dropping him and Rose into a very Tom Baker environment was almost like my whole reason for doing it.
That makes sense.
The TV series was doing something new and bold. You know, stuff like Aliens of London and World War III. You know, nothing had been in Doctor Who's history like things like that before. Boomtown, you know, wow. And so this was a question of, okay, so everyone knows that's what they're doing with the new series, but I don't know whether you remember through the Virgin Books era, there was this constant back and forth on the chat groups and conventions, rad or trad?
Yes, very much so.
Well, I very much fall in trad. So it was taking a new Doctor and a new companion from new series and dropping them into a scenario that you could have imagined Tom Baker and Liz Sladen or Louise Jameson. Very much a Philip Hinchcliffe era horror story from the 70s, but applying all the sensibilities of the new series to it and just see what you get out of it.
Yeah, it's excellent. And creating a villainous double act in Nathaniel Morton and Miss Payne, which they must have been good fun to do, just to come up with a good old-fashioned, the guy who you think's the villain but isn't really, it's the pirate captain,
yeah,
and the nurse again.
Yeah, so very much along those lines, although again, given recent sort of events and conversations, the fact that I have a villainous character in a wheelchair may not be something that necessarily would have passed through Bram's protection these days. But again, I'm not being clever here. It's a spooky old house. It's a villainous nurse. It's Hammer horror. It's broad strokes, but hopefully with an extra level to it that brings it up to a 21st century aesthetic without necessarily going completely down the tropes of stuff that would be done down in the 60s and the 70s. You have to do something to bring it up to date.
Yeah, and something that I enjoyed as a child, I loved Enid Blyton, likes of Famous Five and Secret and Seven. And here we've got Ali, of course, working alongside Rose, and we've got this tunnel going into the mysterious old house, and that was absolutely, that just sort of tickled my childhood gene. Thought, if I'd been, you know, 7, 8, 9 reading that, that would have been just exactly what I wanted. I take it that was a deliberate nod.
Yeah, I mean, deliberate's probably a bit too, it sounds like I thought about it a bit too much. It was definitely there. I knew I was writing for a slightly younger audience. And I mean, I was delighted that the review that came out in SFX magazine said the adventure of Enid Blyton combined with the brio of Hergé's Adventures of Tintin. And to me, okay, I'll accept that one. I'll take that. Thank you very much. So I think I set out to do an old-fashioned adventure, and I think I got there. I did enjoy writing it. It does seem to have gone down well, and it did go down well with an awful lot of children. And I think it's because, as I was just saying, I don't think Tennant, Doctor and Rose had been put in this situation on television yet. So I was fortunate in to get there first with that particular set of elements together.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier Tony Head doing the talking book version, which of course was cut down. No, it was one of the earlier ones, wasn't it, before they started doing the full length ones? Mm. So how did that come to you? Did you get involved in that, or was it just one that came, you just got to hear it when it was done?
No, I mean, I think I'm right in saying that Jack Rayner did the abridging of the book. I'm not 100% about that, but I think Jack did the abridgment. Abridgment, is that the correct word?
Let's go with it. If not, yeah. It should be. It should be.
But then I was invited to come down to the recording, because they wanted to do this little interview between me and Tony Head. Sort of, I think all of the audio books that year had the authors talking to whoever was reading them. But yeah, it was great. I mean, it was really nice. I mean, I'll admit I'm not a massive audiobooks fan. I don't find that they hold my attention the way that opening a book and just settling in does. But I'm delighted that it's out there, and it was great to see him or listen to him reading it. But yeah, I can't honestly say that I've listened to it from beginning to end.
So how do you look back on the whole The Nightmare of Black Island experience? I suppose as your first experience of writing for the new series, it was a good one.
Yeah, as I say, when I started, I was very well treated. I mean, as I say in the acknowledgements, Justin was incredibly loyal. He knew that I'd had this opportunity to do one, and I'd passed on it, so he was determined to get me back again. And at the time, in charge of brand at Cardiff was a gentleman called Ian Grutchfield. And I spoke to Ian during one of the rap parties. I think it was the rap party for series one. And I said to him, how do you feel about somebody who is a member of your crew writing a book? Do you think there's a conflict here? Do you think I should be doing it, basically? And he was like, oh God, no, definitely go ahead and do it. You know, he said it makes our life quite easy because you've been cleared, you know the show, you've read the scripts. We don't have to go through all that business of, can we send scripts out to this person? He said, so no, he said, I think you should do it. He said, the two worlds that you inhabit are very different. And as long as you can make sure that one doesn't interfere with the other. So yeah, it was a very good experience, and I'm very, very pleased with the end result. You know, it's a favourite book, as I said, partly the fact that I'm flying solo, and yeah, it's a proper Doctor Who horror story of exactly the kind that I used to enjoy watching.
Perfect, Mike. Thank you so much. Huge thanks to Mike. Always a real pleasure to chat with him. In fact, Stevie, as we record, next weekend he's at a convention type thing about horror films in the north of England, and Dave and I are going to go down to that because we enjoy going to conventions, and this one, it's only about two and a bit hours drive for us. It's called The Monster Men, and it's got Mike Tucker, Robert Alsop, who made The Candyman, Steve Mansfield, another Doctor Who Monster Maker. I think he made The Destroyer.
Sorry, did you say somebody made The Candyman?
Yeah.
No, Kenny, he was real.
Okay, he was real. Okay.
He came out of a packet. He was scary.
But also at this event, it's going to be Steve Gallagher, writer of Warrior's Gate and Terminus, and Glenn McCoy of Time Lash fame.
Warrior's Gate, yes, and Terminus, I loved. Yep. Wasn't such a fan of Time Lash.
I'm actually, I rewatched part one last night when I was building my Lego X-Wing, so yeah, it's coming together. But why don't we pop over to do a contemporary review? Because literally, I've just called one up just now. I've got the Doctor Who magazine review from issue 376. And let's find out who was doing the reviews in these days. It was... MM. So it was Matt Michael. So we trust him. Matt's got a good judgment. So let's hear what Matt had to say. As night falls and the children begin to sleep, horrific mutants creep from the woods around Innis D to menace the locals and murder anyone who gets in their way. Near the beginning of the book comes a memorably horrid sequence in which the Doctor and Rose stumble across the gory remnants of a monster attack before fleeing through the monster-infested woods. This sets the scene for the creepiest of the three novels, and also the most traditional, with the Doctor saving a small community from an alien menace. Mike Tucker has done horrendous sea monsters and dark dreamscapes in his previous books, and brings everything he's got, including a brief cameo from a Dalek, to Black Island, to create a crisp, straightforward action adventure that comes across like Enid Blyton crossed with Simon Clarke. So there we go. Oh, and here we go, just because there's two other books to read at the same time. It also benefits from the kind of domestic bias that's featured in many Series 2 episodes, placing the children of Innis D in danger, and linking this to sinister events 70 years before, Tucker puts some real heart into the Nightmare of Black Island. So there we go. We're not the only ones who liked it. Yay.
No, that's and they're saying a lot of the things we said.
Yeah.
I think I've obviously missed out on these books as they've passed, but yeah, I would say to anyone, pick it up. It's a good read.
So there we go. I think it's fair to say that The Nightmare of Black Island gets a massive thumbs up from us.
Absolutely.
And everybody, remember, you can follow the Power of Three podcast on Twitter at Power of Three Pod with the number three. You can find us on Facebook, where we've got our group in there, and I need to keep remembering to update the episodes when new ones drop in there. I do them about 3 or 4 days late, which is not very good. And you can follow me personally on Twitter. I'm at Finished Scene. Stevie, you can find at
Stargate 42 Films.
Indeed, with 42 as a number.
42 as a number, yeah.
Yes, just in case there's anybody who thinks they want to write it out in full, even though it probably wouldn't fit into the Twitter handle content. My goodness. So there we go. That's another one of our books done, and we really hope you enjoy it. And we recommend you to go and get a copy if you've not got it, or if you have got it, dig it, reread it, because you're going to have fun.
I think you can get these from libraries too, can't you? Because
indeed,
they were doing an electronic version of this, I believe, years ago, which I assume is still available.
There we go. I'm sure that there will be. And of course, you can get the audiobook as well, although it is edited down, but still very good fun, as we said, with Tony Head.
And a free jar of coffee.
That was
not an impersonation of him, I should add. That was just me being silly. I'm not even going to try and do him.
Yeah, well, I think you should hit me with a question, Stevie, because I've thought of a really good tune to play out with.
Kenny, over the many years of living in rectories and hearing ghostly and wailing sounds coming from distant rooms, which turned out to be my sister and her record player, what would you think would be a really good sort of tune to play out with if you lived in a vast and big rectory that maybe took, I don't know, on a bike, 7 or 8 minutes to go from the kitchen to the laundry pantry?
Well, I suppose it depends if you're looking to irritate your parents, particularly if they are a member of the clergy, pop on a bit of Madonna and Like a Prayer, but we don't want to give you that. I was thinking something that slightly more tenuous, because of course the title of the book is
Nightmare Black Island, Kenny.
That's right, Stevie, well remembered. Caught you in the hop there with that one. And of course, things set in an island of course is quite distant. One of my favourite books is by Alex Garland, and it's set on an island and it's called The Beach. Unfortunately, the movie version isn't very good compared to the novel, but it does have that wonderful track Pure Shores from All Saints. So let's have a little bit of Pure Shores before we go.
I'm disappointed. I thought you were going to do the theme tune to The Famous Five.
No, I don't want
the 1980s version.
I don't want to pay Gary Russell copyright in his singing voice.
Oh, I see. That's a good point.
No, we don't want to give Gary Russell money. We buy his books. That's enough. Thank you. So until next time, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back very, very soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.